Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Repeak. We are a show about remakes, reboots, and revivals because nothing is original anymore. My name is Diana Olympia.
And I'm Stephanie Kim. I was going to do a bit and I don't remember the melody anymore.
You can look it up if you want. You can put it in later.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember now. Who's been messing up everything? It's been Agatha all along. I don't understand why I try to sing in every single episode we do, even though I clearly love it and hate it at the same time. But what did you think of that song, Dio?
Yeah, it wasn't a banger for me. I know people are really into it, and there's that trap remix.
Oh my God, there's a remix?
There's specifically a trap remix. Oh, it's not just any remix. My God. It's a trap remix that went viral. Yeah. So people like it.
Okay.
It's much like the show. A lot of people like it, and I respect the craftsmanship. Wasn't a personal favorite.
Interesting.
Pretty much sums up my feelings for the whole show, which we'll get into.
Yeah, that's interesting. If you haven't guessed already, today's topic is the meta genius Disney original series WandaVision, which premiered in January of this year. But first, we will do some news items for old time's sake. By the way, welcome to season 3, everybody.
I know, we didn't talk about that in the last one.
Yeah, we're officially in our third season of podcasting. How do you feel, Dio? Do you feel like podcasting toddlers now instead of infants?
Yeah, no, we're definitely kind of crawling, like still maybe not walking or running, but less Google Gaga. We have like some words formed. We can say mommy and daddy. So progress.
Yeah.
Okay, so for news, it's funny, coming off of our Justice League episode, talking about the hashtag release Snyder Cut kind of fan campaign. Pretty much immediately after the weekend's release, there are now new campaigns that are starting to surface. One of them, also in the DC universe, I'm going to butcher this name probably, but there's hashtag Ayer Cut, David Ayer, who directed the first Suicide Squad, mm-hmm. allegedly, you know, has a more comprehensive, cohesive vision that he has said basically would be better, which feels different than, like, it's a different situation because it sounds like in the Snyder version, obviously there was a bunch of stuff that he had shot, then he had to step away from production for family reasons. This is a guy who had already shot it saying, like, no, but, like, there's a better version I could have done. And it's like, well, then why didn't you just do it? But
well,
maybe I don't have context.
Yeah, I mean, I actually would be really interested to see the air cut of Suicide Squad because I don't know if you paid attention. For some reason, I was super keyed into this particular launch. I think I was really excited about Margot Robbie playing Harley Quinn and more backstory on her and the Joker. And so I think everybody was super jazzed for this because it was supposed to be super dark. And David Ayer, if I'm not mistaken, is known for things like Training Day and other like really dark movies. And so I think that everybody kind of signed up for one thing and then the studio intervened and like messed it up and made it into something else. And so I actually would be really interested to see an air cut of Suicide Squad.
Yeah, so that's fair. I guess where I was going with this is that the other fan campaign, I don't know if it's a fan campaign, but just kind of this notion of, you know, unreleased director's cuts is Mrs. Doubtfire. People were queuing off of a 2005 interview with director Chris Columbus, known for his Harry Potter, Home Alone, many, many movies. I guess he had made a joke that there was an NC-17 version of Mrs. Doubtfire. He clarified that recently to say there isn't an NC-17 version, but there is an R-rated version because basically Robin Williams, obviously huge improv guy, RIP. So, you know, he would do the cuts as they were intended and then he would say, let me play. And so they would do, you know, 15, 22 takes of him just kind of having fun with it. And some of those takes were R-rated. So he has said that he wouldn't kind of redo a whole cut, but he would consider doing like a documentary, you know, probably in a vein to kind of help celebrate the life of Robin Williams and then also kind of integrate some of these R-rated cuts. But I guess I just bring it up because, just kind of continuing off of our discussion of like, is it a good thing that, you know, the Snyder Cut did so well? Because now it's just encouraging, further encouraging, as if the fans needed more encouragement, but further encouraging kind of this revisionist history, which is interesting contextually to bring in Tay-Tay, not to, you know, try to go out of left field here, but I think the Taylor Swift redoing her masters is a really interesting take in kind of revisiting your music and kind of recontextualizing it, because she's bringing in new people. She's bringing in Maren Morris to new tracks that she never released for the albums. She's also bringing in her friends, Selena Gomez, and it is rumored that she's going to be bringing in Katy Perry for something. Can you imagine if they redid Bad Blood? The world would explode. Like, but just that kind of artistic exercise of being able to revisit something that you've created and kind of redo it, either because you didn't have time, the studio, the label, whatever. I just think it's a really interesting time that we're living in, that these things are happening, because I think before it wasn't even really an option. It was like, whatever's out there is out there. And now things are getting second, third lives. And I don't know, it's just kind of interesting.
I think it's really interesting. And I think it actually, if I were a studio, I'd be really nervous.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think that's like the question is like, you know, there's always been kind of this tension between fan service and like kind of responding to what fans say and kind of charting your own path. And it's a very delicate balance, because as soon as you start feeding into that, then I mean, it becomes no more than like fanfic to a certain extent, right? Like, you know, there has to be some sort of balance, but I don't know. It's really interesting. But to kind of go back to Suicide Squad, it is being rebooted because it did so poorly. New director.
It actually did well in the box office. It did well financially, just poorly critically.
Yeah, you and I actually saw it together, and I couldn't
see it together.
Yeah.
Why do I always forget what
you,
we see?
Yeah,
together?
I've said this to you many times, and you always forget.
I'm so sorry.
No, it was not a memorable experience, because I was just going to say, I can't tell you a single thing that happens. Like, Viola Davis shows up and gives the spiel about how it works. Margot Robbie's there. Will Smith is there?
Will Smith is there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Will Smith is there. That's it. I don't know what happened in that movie. So James Gunn is now in the director's chair. His trailer just dropped over the weekend. Did you get a chance to watch it?
I haven't watched it yet, but I was going to ask you about it. Did you watch it?
I watched it. It was okay.
Did it make you excited, or were you just kind of like, eh?
I was but I'll tell you what, I'd much rather have an trailer and a good movie than a good trailer and an movie, because so many times you get the latter and it just gets like, I'm not about to name drop, but there's a lot of movies that I was disappointed at because of their trailer. So I'm hopeful about it. I think anytime Margot Robbie's there, it's a good time. I really like Birds of Prey, as I always say. So yeah, we'll see. It'll be an interesting, we'll obviously cover it. So it'll be interesting to see how they do it this time around.
Yeah, I'm really excited, actually. I don't know why I keep being really excited for these comic book movies that are terrible. It's like, you know, when you keep going back to like an abusive relationship that doesn't do anything for you, and then you're just...
It's because you're thinking it's going to be better the next time.
Isn't that like the definition of insanity?
God. I have to put this TikTok in the show notes. I don't know if you've seen it. So it's this little boy. He's holding a dead fish and he's crying. And his dad is saying, you have to throw it back. And he's like, I want it. And he's like, no, you have to throw it back. And this kid is just like crying over this dead fish that he wants to keep. And I think the caption is like, this is how girls are with like boys that have like screwed them over. It's like a dead fish that you're holding. And it's clearly like not something you should keep. But for whatever reason, you just really want to hold on to it. It's hilarious. I just feel like that describes it all.
Very apropos for our entire show and my entire relationship with comic book movies and the topic of today's show also.
That was it for me.
All right. Well, I just saw online that you tweeted, Dio, about a potential Ally McBeal reboot. And I am at once surprised and not surprised about this, but also a little bit intrigued. And I was just curious, like, what was your relationship with Ally McBeal back in the day? Because I had a very specific, intense one.
So I wasn't diehard, but I definitely watched it. Obviously, Lucy Liu's character was iconic, as was Portia de Rossi's, to be fair.
Yes.
As was who played the one with the stutter? I don't know. All that entire cast.
Richard Fish, who's now on Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he was great too. Just a really strong cast.
No. That Richard Fish was not the one with the stutter, but the one with the stutter was also on Grey's Anatomy.
He was, yeah.
Yes.
Pretty much everyone's been at Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
But, you know, Dancing Baby, all that. It was a very, I feel like it was a pretty seminal movie, seminal series of the 90s. I can't say I had like a very personal connection to it, but I definitely watched it and was aware of its kind of power within the pop culture sphere. What about you?
Yeah, I was obsessed with Ally McBeal. I also went through a whole phase of like, watching all of the David E. Kelly Boston shows. I was really obsessed with The Practice and Ally McBeal and Boston Public. And I really wanted to, when I was little, my whole plan was to become a lawyer and move to Boston because of these shows. And I actually was a more diehard Practice fan, but they actually were the first TV shows that I was aware of that did crossover episodes. And they did several, like, I think they did like 3 crossover events with The Practice and Ally McBeal. And it was just, the highlight of my universe at the time. I was obsessed. I loved Dylan McDermott. I love Calista Flockhart. I loved Taye Diggs and Lucy Liu. And I love whenever Lucy Liu walked into the room, they did the Wicked Witch of the West. It was so good. And I don't know that a show that quirky and also like very politically inappropriate could be redone now in a way that captures the same like spirit, but is also, I would imagine, like more PC. I'm not sure how that would work.
Yeah, that's interesting. 2 questions. 1, The Practice was on ABC, correct?
Yes.
Interesting. So they were doing an ABC Fox.
Yes.
Crossover.
They did it at least 3 times. Yeah, it was a really big deal.
Can you think of any other creator expanded universes that crosses network lines? I mean, maybe from the production side, it's all the same. Like it could have been they both could have been Fox production, just one airing on ABC kind of thing. But I can't really think of anything else like that.
No, I can't. I can't really either. But this is like very early on in my consciousness of, you know, of TV. And so it was a really, so there may have been obviously prior to, but it's the first one that I was aware of. And it also, it kind of laid the groundwork for everything we're going to talk about today, because I feel like without that kind of like crossover synergy, like, would we really be in the media ecosystem that we're in right now?
Yeah, I do think, though, one of the things that I want to talk about is if they've kind of created a little bit of a monster, though, because as exciting and fun as it is to have that synergy within an expanded universe, there is the danger of setting up expectations of the level of that synergy, meaning to say fans come to the TV show expecting all these breadcrumbs leading to the movies. And so a big chasm between the people who've watched WandaVision is A, people who, you know, avoid spoilers and just watch it like normal people, and B, psychopaths like me who read every single spoiler and then are disappointed when shit doesn't happen that fans basically created up in their own community forums. But that being said, part of what Marvel, I think part of that is fan-driven, proactive kind of, you know, creativity, but it is also a learned behavior. Marvel has set this whole thing up so that you're rewarded by watching all the Avengers movies, by watching all the individual movies of the superheroes, and then seeing all these things tie together. So I think, you know, it's interesting because I think there were a lot of people like me who didn't think that they were going to watch the show, but then heard all these things like, oh, it's going to tie into Doctor Strange, and like Phase 4 is going to be like a lot of things tying together. It's like, and Doctor Strange is going to tie into Spider-Man and all this stuff. So I was like, okay, I'll watch it. And, you know, had I gone into it knowing that it was a self-contained story about grief, I think the experience would have been a little bit different. And I found myself actually not enjoying, but like the fun part of it was reading the theories. I don't know if I had as much fun watching the show. It was more like an appreciation of the craftsmanship, but it didn't feel as fun. And I guess that makes sense because it's a story about grief. But to circle back really quickly, because I had a question, because I wasn't really surprised at the news, given where we are in the reboot, revival, repeak world. I guess what specifically made you surprised that this is in the works?
I guess it's more of unpacking what I said before, whereas like I loved Ally McBeal back in the day, but I very much loved it because I didn't know any better. And I feel like it isn't the most politically correct show. It also, you know, even when it was on, it became under fire for the short skirts that Calista Flockhart was wearing, for the way that Calista Flockhart's character, Allie, like built her entire life around Billy. And that was like her main kind of motivation, was to like get the love of her life, her childhood sweetheart, back. And I just don't, like, I'd be really interested to see a reboot, but I just don't know how a show like that exists in, like, a post-Me Too world.
Yeah, and so I guess the question becomes, as a fan, would you rather see a re-envisioned Ally McBeal that is more kosher to today's world, or would that ruin the whole thing?
I'm kind of the mind that it would ruin the whole thing. Like, I, even though I know that there are certain things about Ally McBeal that weren't quote unquote politically correct back in the day, like I rewatched it relatively recently. I've watched it, you know, within the last 5 years, and I fucking love that show. And I just don't, know if you could like redo that 90s dancing baby and have it be as quirky and weird as it was, and like also like all of her kind of the things that she thinks in her head, you know, her popping up in a coffee cup and like having a sexual fantasy about Billy's wife, and also like about like all the little things that she has to do in her head, like her singing. Like, I feel like everybody would be like, are you the mental illness? it's really intense. But at the same time, there was also things about that show that were really ahead of its time. Like, I feel like the unisex bathroom was super ahead of its time and unique and made for really like funny situations. So I would be interested to see like stuff like that again. But I also I don't know if it works. I feel like it would kind of lose its magic if you were to redo it. And I feel like so much of the show's success hinged around Calista Flockhart and the way that she specifically delivered her lines, the stutters and everything. Like, that was all stuff that was unique to her. And then they just ended up writing it in because it became popular.
Yeah, and I think that what you're talking about to me is the whole catch-22 of this entire repeak ecosystem, is fans feeling like, oh my God, I miss these characters so much. I miss this world. I want to see more of it. But it's not quite the same as like seeing the Backstreet Boys 20 years later in concert. Like, that can, you know, is much closer to just sort of being the same as it was, right? It's just more, maybe you feel more appropriate because you're not like a 12-year-old lusting after a grown-ass man. But, you know, here you have to have all that context or all that content recontextualized. And so, but, you know, will that harm, to your point, the original magic of it? And so oftentimes I feel like what people think they want is in fact not what they want. Like, you should just rewatch it. You don't want a reboot. You don't want a revival. You just want an excuse to marathon the original thing. Like, there have just been so few of these things that have successfully recaptured the original magic and added a new added newness to it. It just, it's really hard. And so, yeah, I think that's a great point about, and this is my thing with Sex and the City.
Yeah.
Sex and the City doesn't make sense in 2021. Like, it just doesn't. A lot of that style of even just like feminism, I feel like the 2000s, like pop feminism of it all, like, that's just not how it is these days.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. And but then again, it's like, okay, so fine, we reboot it, but we'll have a ton of diverse writers. Does that make it better? Maybe. Is it going to be the same show? No. So no. Will I like it? I don't know. Like, it'll be cool to have storylines, hopefully, that are more reflective of the real world and not just the world that for mostly heterosexual women who are very rich, how they live their lives in Manhattan, a more expanded view of that world. But is that Sex and the City? Not really.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very on the fence about this. I'm interested to see what develops, but I am skeptical at the same time, especially because a Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life, I feel like it really ruined the entire show for me. I had to really, like, take a step back and be like, all right, like, let's just compartmentalize and just agree to treat A Year in the Life as not canon, and then I'll be less upset. And so I don't know because I feel like Ally McBeal was such a defining show of the 90s. And it even, you know, before Iron Man, I feel like what really reinvigorated Robert Downey Jr.'s career was his stint on Ally McBeal. That's what I knew him from primarily when Iron Man came out. I was like, oh, it's the dude from Ally McBeal. And so I just don't know that, like, that cast specifically all together was magic. The Sub-Zero Nell, Portia de Rossi, and Taye Diggs, and Lucy Liu, like we've already said. And even, like, Jane Krakowski, was that her name? And she was so weird when she basically plays the same character on 30 Rock. Like, but...
And Kimmy Schmidt, sort of.
Yeah.
To a certain extent.
I just don't know if you can, like, catch that lightning in a bottle twice. Or if it should even be attempted. But you know one show that I've been rewatching recently for just warm and fuzzies that I really wish they would reboot?
What?
Happy Endings.
It also ties in to today's show because there is a Happy Endings reference in WandaVision.
Is there?
Yes. We'll talk about it in a second. But I just wanted to make one quick comment about Gilmore Girls. And that is, I basically only watched A Year in the Life just to find out what the final three words were. She wouldn't stop talking about the final three words scene over the course of the entire series. And it drove me mad that we weren't ever going to find out what it was because of all of the back and forth between her and her husband and their issues with Warner Brothers and all that. So I literally watched the whole thing. Spoiler alert, Mom, I'm pregnant is the last three words. I don't know if that was worth it, but anyways.
That's all I have to say about that is...
That's a good way to end this segment. But we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're going to dive into all things WandaVision.
All right.
All right, WandaVision, where do we start? Can I ask this first question just to kick it off?
Sure.
Were you invested in them as a couple, them being Wanda and Vision?
Honestly, no. And when I first heard about WandaVision, I was like, oh, okay. Like, I'm probably not going to watch this.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, I don't
care.
So
why did you watch it?
I think I watched it because it was like having such a moment on the internet, and I have like really bad FOMO. And then somebody said that line of, I heard somebody say it's really about Wanda processing her grief. And that is actually, I was like, oh, okay, I'm interested now. And I very intentionally like waited until all the episodes were out because I don't like fucking with the weekly schedule anymore. I only do that for Grey's Anatomy. Everything else, I don't have the patience for that. And so I waited, and then everybody was kind of so hyped on it that I was like, okay, I'll watch it. But I very much went into it, as you were saying before, I did not expect all of these Easter eggs or tie-ins. Like, I honestly just don't pay that much attention. I obviously like watch all of the Marvel movies, but I'm not one of those crazy psychos with like a Carrie from Homeland board of like red yarn all over it, like doing all the connecting the dots. Like, I just don't do that. I very much go into Marvel movies expecting to turn my brain off and watch this group of people that I've been watching for like 10 years and saying hi to them again. And then being like, after it's over, being like, okay, that's done. I'm done. it's over. I like basically like drag it all to like a delete file in my brain and like don't think about it again. Although I did get really intensely obsessed with Endgame and went to see it in the theater like 3 or 4 times. But, you know, when I heard about WandaVision, I was like, oh, I'm not really like super interested. And then when I watched it, it took a couple episodes for me to warm up, because specifically the first episode, and for those of you who don't know, which like we're really late coming to the show, so if you don't know, I'm not really sure what you're doing here to begin with, but welcome. Not to say you're not welcome here, definitely welcome. But if you don't know, every episode is structured like a different sitcom from years past. So the first episode is structured like the Dick Van Dyke Show or shows from the 50s, and then the second episode is like very much an homage to Bewitched. The third one goes into 70s and like the Partridge Family. The fourth one is the 80s and gets into like Growing Pains territory, which I obviously really loved because I love Growing Pains, and then so on. And as all of those episodes are happening, you kind of figure out why everything is happening. And it wasn't until really the 70s and 80s episode where I was like, oh, I'm like super invested now. So I'm wondering, like, when did you, or it doesn't sound like you had that moment at all where you felt invested. Can you kind of walk me through, like, your thought process?
Yeah, so it's interesting because we had very different viewing experiences, because I was the schmuck who was like, yeah, okay, fine, let's do this weekly thing. And keep in mind, I had come off doing what you did for The Mandalorian Season 2, which is that I was waiting for my partner to finish watching Season 1 so we could watch Season 2 together. And so because of that, I waited and then wasn't participating in the weekly Season 2 kind of discourse. And then we binged it all and it was fun. It was really fun. But it kind of had me thinking like, oh yeah, maybe it would have been fun to watch along, because by the time we watched Season 2, I had heard a bunch of spoilers. And so we watched it weekly. They premiered the first 2 episodes on the first kind of night. So they had a double premiere and then the rest of it rolled out weekly. And it was really hard. You know, if I had to kind of estimate like what percentage of each episode was about paying homage to the decade and the sitcoms and what percentage of the show was actual plot line, it kind of felt like 90-10 for like the first 4 episodes. So you were getting like probably literally like the last 3 minutes of each episode was like, oh, and here's something that's happening outside the sitcom world. And having that on a weekly basis was like kind of a struggle, especially not having any investment in either of the characters individually, nor in them as a couple. For those of you who don't remember, Wanda and Vision, so Vision shows up, actually they both show up, I think, for the first time or really have a prominent role in Age of Ultron.
Which it's not helpful at all that that's by and large the worst Avengers movie and everybody agrees. So I think they were just kind of, they weren't set up for success.
Yes, exactly. And so then when they show up and they're not together, they're like separate characters, they're introduced, they have their own plot line, and then they kind of cross paths towards the end of the movie, and then all of a sudden we go to the next Avengers movie, Endgame, and they're like, they've been together, and it like happens off screen, and it's like, okay. And it's interesting because these are both very, very powerful superheroes in the comics, apparently. And you don't really get that at all. Like, you sort of get it with Vision in Ultron because of how he's created. But Wanda is kind of like, oh, I have like red hands and like sparkles happen, whatever. But talking to people who are more entrenched in the comments, she's like wildly powerful. She's like apparently Thanos level, and that doesn't come across. Yeah. And so you're coming into this and you're like, okay, here's the like B characters, much like Falcon and Winter Soldier is, sorry, but like, here's these B characters. We're going to throw them a TV show. They're also a couple, PS. And then they're just going to like kind of play house and play, you know, sitcom. And it's like fun and all. It's very fun. It's very meticulous. It's like beautifully done, like craftsmanship. Again, A++. But in terms of actually creating a new story, it was like, okay, like we're moving the plot like inches at a time. And so it was hard for me to watch it week by week. I agree that probably by the time you get to episode 4 or 5, when they're starting to like have the mix shifts a little bit more, you're getting more plot line, it's more interesting. But my problem was that I was simultaneously reading all these fan theories about these potentially really big breadcrumbs that were going to lead into other movies. I'm talking Fantastic Four. I'm talking Doctor Strange. I'm talking fucking Magneto, okay? Because in the comics, Magneto is the father of Wanda and Pietro, Quicksilver. So there was this big cameo that was teased for the end of the season, and everyone's like, fuck, it's going to be Magneto. Like somebody said, so there's a really big cameo at the end of season 2 of Mandalorian, which I won't spoiler, but it's like really, really big. It's like a really, really big character from the Star Wars movies, right? And this character shows up. And so somebody was teasing the same level of cameo for the end of WandaVision. Guess what? It wasn't. It was fucking White Vision, which is like the same person, the same actor, and like essentially the same character, sort of. Not the same. Not the same as what was being told. So, I guess for me, I was never invested. It was a little bit like the abusive relationship that you were talking about earlier. It's like, no, there's going to be something interesting. One of these fan theories is going to pan out eventually. Okay, none of them did. Like, literally almost none of them.
What about the mid-credit scene at the end with Monica Rambeau and the alien?
They did her dirty. Sorry. Like, Monica is set up to be, like, on par. Like, I thought this was going to be, like, a cool, like, photon, you know, brings in Wanda and like she connects with her on a human level. They fucking like do her. She just like disappears. And then she's like, okay, I'm going to absorb these bullets in front of your kids. And then I'm going to get set off to space for Captain Marvel 2. Like, okay, cool. I don't know, man. Also, shout out to Tiana Paris. She was Dawn originally on Mad Men and got this dope ass role. And she was great. I just wish they would have used her more.
I agree. I think they underused her as well, but I was hoping that that was because they're setting her up for more in the future. That's my hope, but who knows?
Yeah. And so to your point about, you know, getting excited about kind of how the show was framed in terms of grief, and then kind of once we start passing through the sitcom heavy phase, like ultimately, did you feel like it delivered on that story? And I guess, how did you feel about the rest of the show once you got to kind of like the midway point?
Yeah, I mean, I think by the time I got to the midway point, I think I was super invested once we got into the 80s show, specifically because I was a huge Growing Pains fan, and the creators said that Growing Pains was one of the main inspirations, but also that is when, you know, Agatha starts to have a bigger role and like weird shit starts going on. So by the time you're at like the Halloween episode, like I love the fact that Elizabeth Olsen's like in the original Scarlet Witch really campy costume in the Halloween episode. I loved when she's like forced to go back through her old memories and like all of the stuff from Infinity War and all the like all of their couple moments. Like, I do think it was successful. I think the finale was a little bit of a letdown for me, as it was for a lot of people. But at the same time, I mean, I just fucking love the Katherine Hahn reveal. Like, I love Katherine Hahn, and she was amazing in this. And I do think that it really did deliver for me, because I am way more invested in her, Elizabeth Olsen, now than I ever was. And in that couple, like, after I watched WandaVision, I went back through and, like, rewatched Infinity War and Endgame. And, like, the nuggets of their relationship are there. It was just never, like, anything that I really, like, waited to watch for or anything. And so now, revisionist history and whatnot, like, I am very invested in this couple and I really want them to be happy and I really want her to be happy and figure her shit out. Yeah, so I really liked it. And I also, I felt a little bit excited but also confused by the theater of it all, the Quicksilver, you know, he's from the Quicksilver in all the X-Men movies and then he comes back and I just don't know. Can you explain to me what that was?
Yeah. So in the show or like in the, like within the context of the actual show or?
Like in the show, I kind of get it. Like I loved all of the stuff that they were like when Darcy was like, they recast Pietro and like all that shit. And I was like, oh, that's like fun. And then his name actually being Ralph Boner is actually really funny.
Yeah,
but
Ralph, the off-screen husband. Yeah, so within the TV show, just to quickly recap, like basically it was Catherine Hahn who had like cast a spell on an actor named Ralph. And so he kind of plays the part of Pietro, who is Wanda's dead twin brother, who was played by two characters, technically Quicksilver. So Pietro / Quicksilver appears in the Fox X-Men film series played by Evan Peters. He is portrayed by Aaron Taylor Johnson in Age of Ultron. And allegedly there was like scheduling issues bringing him back, but it was really confusing for folks behind the scene, like folks, fans outside the show, because this was one of the big, what ended up kind of being maybe a red herring intentionally or just misleading breadcrumb, is that everyone was reading into this as this is how Marvel introduces X-Men. So little backstory, Fox basically owned all the rights to the X-Men stuff. Once upon a time, Fox and Disney were two different companies. Now they're together basically in almost everything except for news, which means that Marvel / Disney / Marvel now has the rights essentially to bring into the fold of its MCEU all of the X-Men characters, but it hasn't happened yet. And so that's why people were getting really excited when Monica Rambeau's character says, oh, I know like a physicist or like a space scientist or something. Everyone thought that was going to be Mr. Fantastic Four, who is rumored to maybe going to be played by John Krasinski. So everyone's like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, this is going to be Fantastic Four. And then it was a random doctor person, like nothing to do with it. People had all these theories about how X-Men are going to be introduced, one of them being the multiverse, which is going to be a huge thing in Doctor Strange and potentially going to be a big thing in Spider-Man. So everyone was thinking like, oh, it's going to be like Spider-Man where they're bringing in other actors who have played Spider-Man to represent the Spider multiverse. And so that's what they thought was happening here. And then they ended up going this like actor route. And so it's still unclear kind of from a casting perspective if this was just like a fun tongue-in-cheek, like people will get it, or if there's more. And obviously Marvel isn't saying anything right now, but
I feel like the general consensus was that people were really annoyed because it felt like blue balls.
Yeah, but I definitely can see a world in which they're like, phase 5, multiverse, and like, we're going to bring in fucking like all the people from Fox X-Men. Like, who knows? Like, I feel like the possibilities are endless. And this is what I'm saying. Like, the whole meta synergy like thing with the universe, it's dangerous, right? Like, because you're fucking with the fans. Like, people could see this as trolling. Like, I kind of felt like part of this season, part of this show, it's unclear if there's a season 2, people are saying there isn't, kind of felt like fan trolling, because they're like that the Fantastic Four thing, that was a huge tease. There's no other way you could read that any other way except Fantastic Four, honestly, like in that context. And for them to not do it is like, felt like a big fuck you, I'm sorry. And so I was a little annoyed at that, to be honest. But it is this thing of like, what, whose fault is that? Is that the fans for reading too much into it? Is it Marvel because they set up those expectations and they like putting Easter eggs? It's kind of like, I don't know, it's probably both. But yeah, so that's the whole Pietro thing.
What was your favorite decade episode? And Did you have any Easter eggs that you liked? Like, I remember in the finale when Elizabeth Olsen, like, crashes the car into the house, and then Catherine Hahn has just her shoes under the car, and it's, like, very clearly a Wizard of Oz wink wink. I was like, oh, that's cute. Was there anything that you were like, oh, this is – I vibe with this, or were you just kind of, like, annoyed the whole time?
So on the era thing, I actually would pick the first – well, probably the first and the second, like, 50s and 60s, because I absolutely grew up on I Love Lucy. And I wasn't, like, a big Bewitched or I Dream of Jeannie fan, but I – you know,
you weren't?
Well, just in the sense that that wasn't like what was like playing reruns on in my house. Like, I Love Lucy was the rerun show in my house, and that's just what I grew up with. I'm not anti those shows, but I very much recognize the style of them, and so I really liked those episodes, especially when they did like the animated intro. Yeah. Which, by the way, like, let's see here. Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, who are like the famous Frozen Coco team, they did all of the theme music in this series, and it's just impeccable. Like, you really feel like these things are straight from that era. So I'd pick those two from like completely a style perspective, but honestly, all of them were really, really good in terms of really capturing the detail and like the essence of those periods. But those feel super nostalgic just because I watched I Love Lucy like my entire childhood every Saturday. I will give a super honorable mention to the 2010s because Elizabeth Olsen's Julie Bowen Modern Family impersonation, like not impersonation, kind of like homage, was so good.
So good. And also when Catherine Hahn is like, I came in just in time. She's one split end away from cutting her own bangs. You're just like, this is amazing. Like, I wish. And then at the end, when Vision's like in his full Vision suit and he's in that director's chair, and then he has a moment of like, wait, why am I talking to you guys? Like, what is this? Why do I put mic on it?
Yeah.
That episode is so good.
It's very, all of it's very well done. As for Easter eggs, I'll explain the happy endings one now. So,
oh, yeah.
In the Modern Family episode, they don't really do a Modern Family title sequence kind of parody. They do
it's a happy endings one. I didn't
exactly
see,
yeah,
begin.
So if you've
oh
seen
God.
The happy endings title sequence, they kind of have like these almost like cut out from a magazine, like very flip through different styles, all with happy endings, and they do that here basically with WandaVision. They also sort of kind of do the Office kind of camera sitcom mockumentary thing. But that was my favorite Easter egg because Happy Endings is one of my favorite shows of all time, which was very sadly canceled. That I would always love.
Canceled too soon.
Yeah, that I for sure would want a revival of 100%.
Yeah, like why are they reviving every single thing under the sun except for that show?
Which, by the way, they did an awesome, as many shows have done. They did like a mini revival. They did a quarantine episode. They reunited the whole cast. David Caspi wrote and participated in the Zoom quarantine episode. It was for charity, and I watched it. It was awesome. It was so fun.
Wait, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I don't know if they posted it or if they tried to keep it exclusive so that people would buy it, but it was so good. It was perfect. They somehow came up with a logic wherein, you know, Jane and Brad were separated. Like, I think he was like locked in a storage facilities. I forget exactly how they did it, but you know, they're somehow able to come up with ways to explain why they would have been separated even though they're married. It was really funny. Anyways, what about you? Favorite era and favorite Easter egg? Or were those already what you said?
No, I thought about this for a long time, and at first I was like, it's definitely the 80s one. But no, when I'm thinking about it, I think I really like the Malcolm in the Middle one, and I also really love the 2010s one. The 2010s one is just, the Modern Family cutaways are just so good. And then obviously by the time you're in the 2010s one, everything is unraveling at a more rapid pace. So the plot feels like way more high stakes.
Yeah.
And like you're about to find out some stuff that is really important. And so I feel like that's definitely the climax of the show and therefore my favorite episode. I had no idea. I didn't connect the dots for that happy endings Easter egg, but I'm really glad that you lifted the veil for me because I'm so happy. And I think Now I very much consider that to be my favorite episode.
Nice.
And also that's the one that has the Agatha song in it, right? It was
I believe
Agatha
so.
All along.
I believe so. It's funny. What did you think of Malcolm in the Middle as the pick? When I realized what they were doing, I was kind of surprised because I feel like it's a bit of an underrated family sitcom. It's not necessarily on the kind of Mount Rushmore of family sitcoms, but I also looked back at that era and I wasn't really sure what they should have picked instead, because at that time, I feel like it was a lot more of like animated family sitcoms and like, frankly, ones that were non-white, which I think they would have had challenges with. Like I'm thinking Proud Family or, you know, stuff like that. Or a lot of like Disney Channel stuff, which is not really, you know, would have been tricky. Like Wizards of Waverly, stuff like that. So I don't know. What did you think about that pick?
I never really watched Malcolm in the Middle, but because it was a CBS show, right? CBS is kind of my one blind spot. I rarely ever watch anything on CBS.
I think it was either Fox or ABC, actually.
Oh, well, I still didn't watch it. But I do remember that it was a big deal at the time. Like, I think the ratings were huge at the time. I'm just, like, really happy they didn't do something stupid like 2.5 Men or something like that. And so, you know, and I think that they did that specifically because, I mean, I actually don't remember if Wanda was actually watching Malcolm in the Middle in the Age of Ultron or Infinity War movie, whichever one where she's like locked up. I think it was
Infinity
War.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I misspoke earlier. When I say they show up and they're together, that was in Endgame, but they also have a few small scenes together in Infinity War where basically Wanda sort of accidentally blows up this building in Lagos and then she's kind of under house arrest and Vision is like basically babysitting her, and so they have like a couple of small moments in like the kitchen, and that's when you kind of see the buds of what will later become a romance, but it's not super clear at the time.
Yeah, but if she was, I don't remember right now, but if she was actually watching Malcolm in the Middle like during that scene, I think that's like a nice tie-in. I don't know what else they would have done. I'm trying to
yeah
think.
That's the thing, is like I was surprised, but I was also like, yeah, kind of was probably the biggest one at the time that was surrounding a white family.
Boy Meets World.
I thought about that, but I feel like they also needed to find probably things that had like a very strong style. And I feel like that theme intro and the camera, you know, and kind of how all that works with like the voice or kind of the first person voiceover, like narrator, like picking one of the boys to kind of, you know, do that stuff. Probably made it easier to have as a reference point. Boy Meets World doesn't have that as much. So I think part of it's also style, but I was just curious because I wasn't a huge Malcolm fan either, but I knew it enough to recognize what they were referencing.
Yeah, exactly. Same, me too. And I think that's probably, to your point, is exactly what they needed and why they chose that. And now that I'm thinking about it, Boy Meets World definitely wasn't a family sitcom. It was more about Corey and his friends.
Yeah, I think there was like it's like Disney Channel versus like ABC primetime kind of thing, where it's like, it's not quite, it's just a different audience a little bit. We are going to take a break and then we're going to wrap on our thoughts on WandaVision. You're back. What would you say you were most impressed by in terms of, I guess, anything? I'm thinking more, again, to kind of the detail of trying to pay homage to some of these stories. For me, there's a lot. I mean, the producers have talked about how much detail they went into the first episode. If you watch the kind of behind the scenes episode that they published on Disney Plus about taping the first episode in front of a live audience, you know, the cast and crew, were in period attire. You know, they picked Dick Van Dyke's brain on how they shot. They used like the same cameras and lenses, and they did like, for me, like it was, I think it was like the Wire puppetry. So instead of like using modern day CGI and stuff to do kind of the Bewitched kind of mechanics of all the tomfoolery happening in the kitchen, they actually did all of like the kind of old school Wire style, which I thought was really cool. And it really came across in the episode. But I also really liked all of the commercials. And in particular, the one that I liked, yeah, the most was the, I forget which era it was, but it was the yogurt one.
Where it's like I was about to say, I think that was in the middle episode. It was like the, the claymation one.
Yeah, because it was one of those things where, like, it was evoking a lot of things from my childhood that I couldn't quite put my finger on, but it was very nostalgic at the same time. Like, I thought of Street Sharks, Gushers, Go-Gurt, all those things. It felt very, like, Nickelodeon era. I don't know. Anything else that kind of jumped out at you in terms of the production side of it?
I think it was really that. And then also, I was just really impressed with Elizabeth Olsen's performance and Katherine Hahn's performance, and just the level of detail that the production staff went into. Like, I was just rewatching that behind the scenes featurette you mentioned right before we hopped on, and they mentioned how for the first episode even the crew dressed up in costume to get into the spirit of it, and I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then they recreated the same lighting and also used the same chairs that the studio audience would have sat in during that era. Like, all of the effort they went into to make everything period specific and accurate is just really amazing. And I just, there's something really comforting about, like, even when they go into the 70s style episode and the 80s style episode, like, I just love watching sitcoms like that. That multi-camera kind of setup of, like, everything being centered around the living room and like, knowing the set intimately and, like, it all kind of feeling a little bit fake, but, like, not. It just, like, is such a comforting thing. And I think the thing that really sold me on the show was that, you know, if I were grieving and I had telekinetic superpowers, I probably would do the same thing. Like, I would not want, obviously, to have the terrible consequences of, like, hurting people the way that Wanda did. But, you know, I have, as somebody who has loved TV for as long as I've basically been breathing, I feel like I've very much used TV as an escape. And if I were hurting to that point, I would also want to escape into my favorite shows. And so it just, the whole conceit felt like extremely relatable to me. And also just a general love letter to television, which I really, really appreciated.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. On that note about, you know, I feel like a lot of people connected with the show and the themes of grief. And there was one line in particular that went viral. It is what Vision says to Wanda, I believe, in a flashback.
Grief is just love persisting.
Yeah, in the Infinity War kind of apartment. What is grief if not love persisting? What was your reaction to that line? Because there was a lot of chatter about that online.
I didn't know there was a lot of chatter about that online, but I had just rewatched the last episodes this morning. And when he said that, I had to, like, stop it and be like, oh, my heart did a little pang. Like, I didn't even know that people were really picking up on that. But, like, hearing that, it totally makes sense to me, because I had to stop and be like, shit, the MCU writers are really eloquent. And for what everybody says about comic book movies and all the flack that they get, every once in a while you get a piece of writing like that, and it is so resonant that you're just kind of like, oh, that's why I keep watching these. It's for those kinds of moments and those kinds of insights. And I completely understand where she's coming from, and it made me very invested in her and in Vision and them as a couple and those boys. And it really worked on me. I don't know if I'm just, like, very easily manipulated or what, but I really fell in love with it.
Yeah, no, a lot of people shared your reaction, and I wasn't one of them, to be honest. And I kept thinking about why that was. I don't have a clear answer, but what I was thinking about was that obviously we have been living in nonstop grief for the last year, basically, right? We are in an extremely, we've been in an extremely emotional, precarious state over the last year. And whether or not you know somebody that was impacted by COVID, was impacted by the events of Black Lives Matter last year, have been impacted by, you know, the violent attacks and anti-Asian sentiment that have been going on. There's been a lot of stuff that's been going on affecting a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. And so to me, once I thought about that framework, and then especially obviously if you knew somebody who was impacted, then yeah, I think it totally makes sense that a lot of people had that connection to it. And I'm happy for them. I'm very happy that they could find this piece of the show that really resonated with them, that was beautiful, that they were able to kind of find beauty in, find solace in. And it just kind of made me think, though, because there was a little bit of a heated debate online about the people, again, kind of splitting them into two camps of people who really got it and people who really didn't get it. And it's interesting because I feel like there was a little bit of a, there's a lot of defensiveness. And it just kind of made me think about fandom of things in general these days and how there's just this whole thing of like discourse of people loving a thing, and then there's discourse of people not loving a thing, and then there's like discourse between the two people, groups of people. And I've personally felt this with Raya. I loved Raya, as I have said on this podcast before, and I will continue to say. There was controversy from folks specifically in the Southeast Asian community, of which I am a part of, about the lack of Southeast representation amongst the voice cast, which is completely fair. And I struggled for a time kind of reconciling what I felt was like very loud chatter about that complaint, as opposed to just focusing our energy and voices to celebrate the movie. But I think it's just a function of the time that we live in. And I know that almost all of those people are doing both. They're celebrating the movie and calling attention to a very valid complaint, and one that I share, by the way. But I think it's just this, again, this like very delicate balance and like kind of just the challenge with having just these wide anonymous platforms to make your voice as loud as possible, that sometimes like the thing that you want people to focus on, which is, hey, there's this amazing movie celebrating Southeast Asian representation and cultures, that kind of gets drowned out by the nitpicking, which, again, I'm a nitpicker. We do grapes on the show every single week. But I do think it's just an interesting time to be living in where, you know, sometimes the discourse of challenging things kind of competes with the love of things, if that any of that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. And I think that's one of the things that is most frustrating about fandom in general and the world we live in, because it very much is people kind of take the stance of like, you're either with us or you're against us. And I feel like it doesn't have to be like that. And I also, you know, and you and I have talked about this before, but I also was, for example, not a big fan of the first Captain Marvel movie. And I had a couple of friends who were very, not okay with the fact that I wasn't okay with the Captain Marvel movie, and very much like, I feel like there were a lot of people that were like, well, you have to support it because it's the first female superhero movie in Marvel, and like, so we have to blindly support it. And I feel like it should be okay for us to have different opinions and love things differently. Like, that's what makes things interesting. And I also think it should be okay to love something, but also recognize that it could use more work. Does that make sense?
100%. Yeah. And, you know, I think for me, at least, my whole thing with Raya was definitely like identity projection stuff of like, it just felt like, and by the way, the moment has already passed. And so that was part of the thing of like, this is like a very small window we have to be like seen and be visible, which I feel like, again, ties in with all the stuff that's happening in the country right now and what happened in Atlanta. So for me, I was like very just like, I took it very personally. I was really sensitive about it. And I had to like talk my feelings through with my partner because I was like, why am I so upset about this? I'm part of the same community that is voicing all these concerns. And I don't know, it was like a really big thing for me because I just wanted us to have kind of our Black Panther moment, which like is rife with challenges because of the fact that, you know, this is a movie about a continent of people with different languages. And like, you know, it's not the same thing. But I think what I was trying to get at was like wanting to have this elation of like, this like idealistic 100% solidarity for a thing. And, you know, we're just not going to have a product that is perfect. Like everything that comes out of in the Hollywood system in some shape or form is going to not represent Asians, whether it's Southeast Asians or East Asians or poor Asians. Shout out to the poor Asians, because a lot of the stuff that's coming out.
Yeah, the regular Asians out there.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just, you know, just like economic disparity, you know, things like that. Like, there's just always going to be something lacking, and there's always going to be a part of us that isn't represented. And so it's just a challenge when it comes to that part. But I feel like even if it doesn't, but like, I don't know, in your example, it was a little bit of an identity thing, right? Because people were saying, oh, well, you're a woman. It's the first like woman-led thing. So you got to support it, because if we don't support it, there isn't going to be more of it kind of thing. And so it's just like this very deeply personal thing that becomes very, very tricky, because everyone is coming from the same place. I think ultimately, I really do think that it's just, there's all this other individual stuff that kind of contributes to how we experience the content that just, I think, creates some friction when we end up talking about it online.
I think the reason why people get so up in arms about this in particular is because of the idea of scarcity, of what you just said, you know, like you have to support the first woman-led superhero movie, otherwise they won't make another one. And so I think that that fear is what kind of gets people so sensitive about stuff. And for the record, I did go see Captain Marvel in the theater and like paid for it. I just didn't think it was a good movie. And also my argument was, if Thor gets to have two movies before he makes the third good one, then she should also have that opportunity. But I think people are kind of snap into that like blind loyalty thing when they're afraid that they won't get another opportunity to be represented in a way that feels authentic to them. And so I understand that. And I feel like with the Raya situation too, like I get it, but it's also just like, that's a problem with the system and not a problem with everybody who has their differing opinions. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, yeah, that definitely gets lost. But I agree that a lot of these things come down to scarcity. I feel like that's what my mind always goes to, is just everyone feeling like this is the one chance we get. And so, you know, it has to represent everything, which is literally impossible.
Which is so messed up, yeah. And you literally can't. You can't, though. You can't represent everything all at once. That's the core issue. And you can't please everybody all at once. And nor should you have to. It just, that's not the way society is built anymore. Like, you can't just make one thing and expect everybody to be happy. Like, I feel like the era of the tentpole movie died with Endgame. So I wish everybody would kind of take a step back before putting everything out on the internet and kind of, you know, being upset. I feel like I wish people would be more understanding and like, and understand that it's all a process of like baby steps. And maybe if this one thing is successful, it'll open the door for other things down the road, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm making sense.
I agree. No, I, that's kind of the where my head was coming from with it. But I think this one was, Raya was particularly difficult because it was presented as kind of like a pan Southeast Asia. And so people were naturally going to be a little territorial about, oh, well, my country wasn't represented or whatever. Yeah. And yeah, sure. I was doing my own like Philippines count of like how many references there were. And as I've said, Cassie was supposed to be the main lead, but I'm not going to not support Kelly Marie Tran, and not even in a blind way. Like, she's amazing. She absolutely deserved her chance to shine, especially after all of the Star Wars stuff that she had to endure. So it's funny because it is a little bit meta with the movie. Like, the movie is about these five you know, what was once Kumandra's one kind of united kingdom, so to speak, and then they're kind of separated into like five small ones and are kind of fighting with each other over scarcity, which is this one magical dragon stone. And spoiler alert, the way that the whole thing fixes itself, because all these evil things come out of the woodwork, but is that they come together and they trust each other, and it's all about the kind of the unity as opposed to just fighting for, you know, the one to get the shine, which I felt like was a really interesting meta commentary about the discourse that was happening with the movie that no one has really talked about. And it's just funny because I see so many things about like, oh, they should have done this and they should have done that, and it's like,
did you not watch the movie? Did you not watch it?
I know. And it's like, do I agree that like East Asia and East Asian representations are predominantly what we see in the media? 100%. Would I love to see more Filipinos? 100%. Do I recognize that every single role that Daniel Dae Kim, Steve Yeun gets, and Sandra Oh gets is a step forward for everyone? 100%. And I'll segue this into not really a cheat corner because it is based on a book, but I just watched Nomadland the other night. Which was directed by Chloe Zhao. She's the first Asian, I don't know if she's just, no, because there's Ang Lee. So she's the first woman of Asian descent to be nominated for Best Director at the Oscars. And she's been cleaning up the awards. It was beautiful. So you want to talk about supporting the work out there. It's a little different in that, you know, Minari is by an Asian cast and by an Asian writer director about kind of an Asian story. This is a little bit different, but it's still beautiful nonetheless. So everyone should go see Minari, Nomadland, and Raya. Go support. That's my little pitch.
Is Nomadland the one with Riz Ahmed?
No, that's Sound of Metal, but I've also heard really good things about that. Him and Steve Yeun were both nominated for Oscars, which is amazing.
Which is amazing, yes. Also, to your point, like my intention was not to invalidate everybody else's opinion about Raya. Like, I just want everybody to kind of acknowledge that, like, it's going to take time for representation to catch up to where we are, like representation in Hollywood to catch up to where we want it to be, because so much of Hollywood is still run by these homogenous groups of people. And until that changes, I feel like we're not really going to see everything represented the way that we want. I don't know. I guess it's just like, try to celebrate the wins when we can get them, and like, let's keep on working toward a more representative body of work as a whole.
Yeah, I agree.
And yes, go see Minari and Nomadland, which I clearly have not seen yet, either of those. And I'm really excited.
They're very good. Just to switch back gears to our original topic, I haven't watched Falcon Winter Soldier, very similar to WandaVision. I had absolutely no intention. And then I was like, well, I don't know, they all tie into phase four. But then after seeing WandaVision not really give us anything, which is fine, I just had, you know, a different set of expectations, I was like, well, I don't know, I'm not really going to watch this. So I've just been hanging back, and it's two episodes in. The reviews have not been great. Have you watched it or been paying attention to the talk about it so far?
So yeah, ironically, because of my positive experience with WandaVision, even though I just said I don't fuck with weekly releases.
Wow, you've been watching it?
I have been watching it, yep.
Okay, all right, this is perfect because I need somebody I trust to give me their opinion.
It's not good yet.
So I heard specifically that is boring. Can you attest to that?
Yeah, I agree, but I also think it took WandaVision a little bit to take off. I loved those first couple episodes of WandaVision, but I wouldn't say they were the most like enthralling of the series. And so I'm just kind of waiting for more stuff to unravel. I do think that I love Sam and Bucky, and so just to see them together is kind of nice. I'm like, oh, these are like my friends, and they're missing the same people that I'm missing in Steve Rogers, and that feels somewhat comforting to me. And also Sebastian Stan, man, he just ages like a fine wine. He is just so hot in this that I'm like, okay, I'll keep watching.
That's fair. That's fair.
And yeah, and so I'm watching, but I have not been dazzled thus far.
Okay. I'm going to wait for your signal, because if I don't hear anything, I'm just going to skip this one and just read the Wikipedia.
I also, yeah, I think that might be a safe bet, but I will definitely keep you posted. I think the other thing that maybe I specifically am not responding to the best is that this show in general is like way more masculine in its energy and portrayal and everything. And I'm just less interested in that. I think I was super into WandaVision because it was very much about a woman dealing with her grief and how that's unpacked. And that is just something that is inherently way more interesting to me than like two of Captain America's wingmen being macho and like dealing with their masculinity and like what it means to not be an Avenger anymore or whatever it is.
Speaking of women dealing with grief, is Emily Van Camp, has she showed up yet?
No, but when is she going to? They've mentioned her. Okay. Her name was Sharon, right? Sharon.
Oh, I don't even know because I don't even really know if I've watched all of the Captain America ones.
Sharon Carter. She was Peggy Carter's niece or whatever. I think they've mentioned her. And so I did kind of after the most recent episode of The Falcon and Winter Soldier, I was like, is she coming? Because if she's coming to this show, I'm way more interested in it.
By the way, there was once upon a time rumored that Revenge was going to be rebooted, and then I recently looked it up again, and it was canned. So now I was sad.
Boo. Yeah, so far just like hints here and there of her name, but nothing.
The
serious.
Only other thing that might get me into the show is I can't remember his name right now. I should look it up, but there's apparently a very, very, very hot Australian-Singaporean guy who is in this show who may or may not have showed up yet. But he's very tall and is basically a model. So
I would be really interested in seeing that as well.
I think he's like wearing a mask and like has dark hair so far and like maybe punches a couple people maybe in a clip that I saw. Anyways, keep me posted on that.
Yeah, I will. All right. If you've made it this far, thank you for listening. Please follow us at Repeak Pod on Twitter and Instagram. Send us an email at repeakco@gmail.com and leave us a review, 5 stars. It really helps us out. Please do it if you have the time. Thank you for listening. Really, we really appreciate it.
Be safe, everyone. See you next time.